大家好，欢迎来到六爻的第23期节目。今年的6月16号是人类登月50周年纪念。阿姆斯特朗的名言“个人一小步，人类一大步”，至今仍然点燃无数人对于太空探索的想象。虽然从那以后人类再也没有重返月球，但是50年前的那一壮举在过去这50年中历久弥新，激励了无数人为探索太空的未知而奋斗。今天的嘉宾是一位空间探索的业内资深人士，请他来谈谈登月50年来太空探索技术的发展，并大胆预测一下哪个国家或者私人公司会是下一个在月球和火星登陆的组织。我们人类在今后太空探索中所面临的挑战有哪些，以及登月的商业应用会是怎么样。This week is the anniversary of 50 years of moon landing, so I have a great guest who can share with us not only what happened in the past, but also what is the latest development in terms of moon exploration.
Yes, well, I mean, it's really great to be celebrating 50 years of the moon landing. In fact, it's amazing to think that it's 50 years have passed since men walked on the moon. Of course, now, you know, 50 years have passed and we haven't had any further manned missions to the moon. Although, of course, now we have discovered water on the moon, and the moon was considered to be dead and dry and therefore of no interest. But with the discovery of water on the moon, I mean, not lakes of water, but there's a substantial amount of water, this completely changes what we can do in the future on the moon. Because water not only, of course, provides the essential ingredients for human habitation without having to carry all the water from Earth to moon, which is very expensive. We now can find it in situ on the lunar surface. In order to support human life, to provide food, but also most importantly, that with sunlight, that can be through electrolysis, we can generate oxygen and hydrogen. And these are the essential fuels for moving back off the moon. And so now we don't have to carry all these ingredients to the moon. We can find them on the surface.
So do you think in the near future, people may have the capability to live in the moon in the long term, not just land and go, but also have more long-term settlement?
Oh, I think without doubt. I mean, the discovery of water completely changes the game, I say, for the reasons I've just given, but also it means that now it is affordable. We don't have to carry all the stuff there, so we don't have to have the enormous cost of transportation. And the advances in robotics mean that what we probably will see is robotic preparation. So we will start to build habitats on the moon using robotics first, and then send humans for sustained human habitation. So I'm sure that in the next few years, there's been a great rejuvenation of interest in the moon, and we will see, I'm sure, many nations traveling to the moon, first with robots and then with humans. Initially, of course, for short stays, but what they will then do is to start to prepare the long-term habitats. And so there's talk in Europe of a moon village, which will, we would like to see it as an international village. And of course, one of the problems that we have to face is that of radiation. We are protected on the Earth by the magnetic field and by the atmosphere from the solar radiation, very largely. On the moon, we don't have that protection. So we're going to have to build habitats to protect us from radiation, or possibly explore some of the tunnels that have been discovered on the moon recently. So these are lava tunnels. And these can go down several kilometers into the lunar surface, and this provides us with a natural protection from radiation, and also means you don't have to build great cities on the surface.
And how big are these tunnels?
Well, I don't know. I haven't been there, so I don't know. But I mean, they are quite sizable. So, I mean, obviously, some of the lava tunnels are quite small, but I believe some of them are meters or tens of meters across. And so, consequently, you could use these possibly as a rather like we did in the old days. Humans lived in caves. This will be caves on the moon.
Oh, that sounds cool.
So obviously Donald Trump say America want to return to the moon very soon, and China has been first time land on the dark side of the moon, and ESA is also working very hard, and plus India as well. So do you think which nation or organization might be the next one to land human being on the moon? What is your prediction?
Well, it's very difficult to make predictions, but I think there's been, as you say, a resurgence of interest in the moon. We've seen India with the Chandrayaan missions. In fact, the Chandrayaan mission was the first mission to detect water on the moon.
Oh, really?
It was looking into a deep crater. It had a small radar payload. And we, for the first time, saw some reflections from the bottom of the crater, which could only be accounted for by water ice. And then that sort of rather tantalizing piece of evidence was then confirmed with an American mission, which deliberately crashed into the moon, threw up a lot of lunar regolith. And then the spectral analysis of that regolith showed that there was significant water. And then subsequently, there have been other missions indeed on the surface. So, I think we've seen interest from India, from China. There's now quite a strong international grouping. And in fact, the Israelis sent a private, I think it's probably the first private mission to the moon just this year. It was intended to land on the moon. Unfortunately, well, it did land on the moon, but it landed rather hard. It crashed. But nevertheless, it shows that there's interest from different nations, both in the public sector and the private sector. But the next people I suspect that will be on the lunar surface is China.
Oh, really?
Because certainly the US had rather dismissed the moon, and then with the Chinese interest through Chang'e, both on the near side and then the far side, I think this has perhaps pricked the Americans into taking a renewed interest, because they obviously want to be present on the moon at the same time. And so Donald Trump has made very bold claims to move quickly to get on the moon, I think it's going to take a little while. I suspect that China, in its sort of perhaps more
organized
mode, will may well be first, but we'll see.
But you also mentioned these days there's a lot of private companies that showed interest in the space, from the rocket launch to satellite build. And do you think for the moon landing, with not very clear commercial interest, what kind of role private company may play in the moon exploration?
Well, I think it's actually very similar to Earth, but of course it's going to take longer. It's going to be a smaller community. But when you have a community on the moon, it's a bit like the Antarctic. There are scientists and so forth living in pods, if you like, on the Antarctic ice shelf. It's an international activity. And of course, those scientists need communication. When they're moving around on the Antarctic ice shelf, they need to have positioning. And so when there is a sustained human habitation on the moon, with a sort of moon village, if you like, then the people that are going to be based there are going to need communications. They're going to want to send their scientific data back. I suspect they'll also want to watch Netflix and and everything else. And of course, they want to have their emails back to their families as well as their business. So there's going to be a requirement for a communications infrastructure. And when you're on the surface of the moon, I suspect that the surface of the moon, being sort of grey and dusty with craters, one crater looks very much like the next. And so if you're going to be able to find your way around on the moon, you're going to need a GNSS. So you're going to need navigation, whether it be Beidou or GNSS or Galileo or GPS. So I think the private sector perhaps will have business opportunities to provide that service. So the governments will probably do the expensive bit, which is transporting humans, building the habitation and so forth. And then the private sector can provide the communication services, navigation services, and possibly actually also, like SpaceX, provide the transportation.
Read an article about how much did it cost America for the Apollo mission. The article said in total was around $26 billion that time. Obviously, things has changed dramatically 50 years later. But nevertheless, it's still a very expensive mission to go to there. How would private company be able to recover those costs, even the only small portion of, say, 26 billion?
Well, the 26 billion covered a lot of things. They developed a totally new rocket for it, the Saturn V. And of course, the cost of human space flight makes everything 10 or possibly even 100 times more expensive. And so the real expense is getting humans to the moon, back from the moon, and on the moon's surface safely. And that's going to be the expensive bit. And that's, I think, going to be something that's carried out by governments. If you look at the transportation for robotics, and that means communication satellites, navigation, perhaps on-surface surveyors and robotics, that is a great deal cheaper, or less expensive at least. And so I think this is, you know, perfectly feasible. As I say, just this year, a private Israeli organization, a not-for-profit organization, raised enough money to build a lunar lander and pay for the launch and get it to the moon, and managed to do that, you know, more or less out of philanthropic support. So I think it's quite possible for the private sector to play a part. I think where the expense will come is in the human element.
So because the AI and robotic technology has developed a great deal recently, especially, do you think now it's much cheaper and realistic to launch robotics on the surface rather than sending human, where the most of the cost will happen?
Well, this has been, you know, the debate between robotic exploration and human exploration has raged ever since, actually, the Apollo missions landed on the moon. So sending humans is very expensive. It is, of course, also quite risky. And so when you look at the economics of it, you know, robotic exploration looks very attractive. And of course, robots now are much more capable. AI has advanced tremendously, even in the last 5 years. And so we're now able to do things robotically that were inconceivable before. However, robots and AI, by their very nature, learn from past experience. And the problem in new environments, so as on the moon, is when you're faced with something that you haven't seen before, or you don't recognize, or just you don't even recognize that it's different because you haven't seen it before, then AI has some limitations. And the human brain has the ability to calculate in a very different way. And so I think the argument has always been that robots should go first. They should explore, they should understand the environment, they should prepare if it's buildings or preparation for humans to follow. But in the end, humans currently still have a greater capability to explore the unknown and to react when they see things that were not expected.
And out of interest, I seem to have an impression that the entire moon surface hasn't been mapped completely. And that may also cause some trouble if we just send the robotics to an unknown area without human being be able to make a very quick judgment and so on. Do you think that is also one of the challenges, that it might be better to send a human?
No, I disagree, because actually the lunar surface has been mapped in great detail by a number of robotic missions. So there have been a number of lunar orbiters which have mapped the surface down to actually really quite fine detail. And I forget the exact resolution, but certainly down to less than meters. And so consequently, I think the lunar surface is now pretty well characterized. And so I think from the point of view of moving around on the lunar surface for robots or humans, I think we got a pretty good idea of what the surface looks like, both on the far side, the near side and the far side. I think where we're not quite so, robots are not quite so good, is if we want to explore some of the fine structure, if you want to better spot an unusual meteorite on the surface or something like that. And this will, I'm sure, robots will continue to develop. And actually, I suspect it will be more telepresence that will help us. So, a bit like virtual reality. One of the developments we've seen in the last decade is, the ability to essentially create an avatar where you can have a robot on the moon and you can then operate this remotely from Earth with a degree of fidelity that, you know, clearly wasn't available in the Apollo times, and really only recently has come to be possible. You know, these are using techniques which are, you know, similar to those that are used in telemedicine, you know, remote operations on human beings and so forth. You know, the same type of telepresence means that we can explore the moon sitting here on Earth in quite a lot of detail. But I still think, like most things, the unexpected happens when humans are present.
The reason I got the impression the moon wasn't mapped properly was after the Chinese did the far side of the moon landing, apparently, according to an article I read, that American requests to Chinese to share certain parameters of the orbit with them because American didn't know, and China said no because before their mission, they asked American to share and American refused. So that is why it gave me the impression that that area is still a bit unknown to human being, but maybe it's more about orbit rather than the moon surface.
No, in that case, no, you're absolutely right. It's the orbit. The moon is not a terribly homogeneous body in the sense that it's quite a difficult body to have stable orbits around because they get perturbed. And so particularly when you're orbiting close to the lunar surface, it is really quite difficult to predict exactly the progression of the orbit. And so I'm sure that as you come in to make a lunar landing, particularly if it's a soft landing, then the parameters that would affect the final trajectory and the orbits in low lunar orbit, you know, aren't that well known. The surface is, you know, optically quite well characterized, but the mass concentrations which affect the orbit parameters are less well defined, and I'm sure that's why those requests were made.
Okay, so let's talk about a little bit more about the communication to the moon, should there well have a permanent camp there. At the moment, not like Earth, where we have geostation can provide basically global communication. The moon hasn't set up a complete telecommunication system per se, so that can cover everywhere from the moon. Is that right? And if so, what is the plan any government or private company is thinking to provide such a coverage for from the telecommunication point of view?
Well, the moon, of course, is different from the Earth in the fact that it's actually the lunar facet is phase locked to the moon, to the Earth. So one side, you know, that we see all the time is always looking at the Earth, and that's why we have the far side, and that's why Chang'e had to have a relay satellite in the Lagrange point beyond the lunar, further behind the moon, if you like, from the Earth, in order to be able to see the far side. And so I think what we will see is that there will clearly be a need for communications satellites in such a position. The Lagrange points are stable positions where the gravity of the moon, the Earth and the sun and everything sort of balance out. And so a satellite placed there remains put. But it also, if it's on the far side, it can see the whole of the far side. So one of the advantages is the near side, we can always see it somewhere on Earth. The far side, we can never see. So we have to have at least one satellite sitting at the back side of the moon, so to speak. And you know, that's clearly going to be, you know, one of the plans, I'm sure, that the both the private and the public, you know, government sectors will do, because, you know, that's the way to provide continuous communications. The problem is, you know, some of the areas in the polar regions are going to be a bit trickier, so that's going to require a bit more thought.
So are you saying actually we only need one satellite at the far side, because the near side you can always just communicate from the Earth, and therefore the cost wise is actually manageable?
I think it's a little more complicated because yes, we have the near side is always visible. The far side we can have one satellite. The problem comes in the lunar polar regions. A little bit, actually, like the Earth. The Earth polar regions are difficult. And so on Earth, we have types of orbits called typically a Molniya orbit, which is a highly elliptical orbit, which provides coverage on the polar regions if needed. I guess something similar could be done for lunar communications. However, the problem there will be, well, the problem, but the thing we have to consider is that the lunar orbits are not terribly stable because of these mass concentrations. And I haven't actually looked at it, so I don't know quite how difficult a problem it is. But, you know, I'm sure if we want to have habitation in the polar regions, and there's some advantages in that, because that's where the water is likely to be trapped, in the bottom of the craters. And also, one of the problems on the lunar surface is the lunar night. So it gets very hot during the lunar day, and it gets extremely cold during the lunar night. And you know, trying to live through that is quite difficult. So that's where the lava tubes living down in a cave will even out the temperature. But of course, it does mean during the lunar night, you don't have any power. So one of the advantages possibly is to live at the polar regions, because there are some areas which are, you know, the points of eternal light, as they say, where they always see some sunlight, and that might be quite attractive. You'd have trapped water ice, you possibly have continuous solar illumination, but then you'd have to provide communication services for it.
People always ask, what is the purpose of going to the moon? Some people, such as Chinese government, say there's a lot of rare materials in there that we can make use, but the cost of extract them is so high, I personally do not see the point. So I guess different people has their own answer why we go to moon, but what is your view? Is that just a stepping stone to other for further place like the Mars, or there is some real practical benefit going to the moon?
Well, again, this is one of those questions that has, you know, been floating around, you know, forever, but certainly in the last 50 years. It is very difficult to build a convincing business case to go to the moon. Now, yes, there probably are some rare materials on the moon. But to be honest, until we run out of them on Earth, and we're not near that yet, although there's some are getting scarce, it seems improbable that's going to be really economic, unless they discover some. There are a few things like deuterium and others which might be slightly more prevalent on the moon due to solar bombardment. But again, it's sort of unlikely that that's really going to be a sound business case to bring back, but we'll wait and see. So from a business case, doubtful. From the other end of the spectrum is, why do people climb Chomolungma? They climb it because it's there. You know, in 500 years ago, why did people set sail from China and from Europe to go over the horizon? You know, because it was there. And exploration always throws up the unexpected benefits, unexpected knowledge. And so traveling to the moon, you know, I'm sure, will advance our technology and our knowledge. And in many cases, these developments can be put to use back at home by improving our technology on Earth. So, yes, we can do it just because it's there and it's in the human spirit to explore. Then there's something in between, in the middle. And in the middle, you have a couple of things. First of all, there is the drive for advanced technology. And secondly, of course, there's national spirit and national pride that countries want to be able to demonstrate that they have a high technology capability. And there's nothing more challenging, perhaps, than going to the moon. And of course, finally, the moon can be seen as a stepping stone to Mars. Again, 10 years ago, before the discovery of water on the moon, didn't seem like a very sensible stepping stone, because you had to carry all the fuel there and then to move on out. And, you know, why bother to do that? Might as well go to Mars straight away. However, now that there is the potential for creating fuel on the moon, and it's much less energetic to get off the moon to go to Mars than it is to Earth, it is, you know, conceivable to now use the moon as a staging post. So we go to the moon first, then fuel up there, and then go on to Mars. I think there's also another element of reason. If we are going to go to Mars, Mars is a half-year journey at least to get there and to get back. And while you're there, you know, it's pretty remote, and the communications times are quite long. And so anything that you're going to have to rely a lot on artificial intelligence and robotics to support humans on Mars. So going to the moon, where the communications delays are seconds rather than minutes, allows us to check out all the support systems, all the AI, all the communications processes that will be needed for Mars. But the moon is basically a day trip. Maybe a bit of a long day trip, but nevertheless, it's a couple of days. So yeah. You can get back if things go wrong. The communication links are much closer. So we can check everything out on the moon before we commit to Mars, which is a much bigger venture.
So let's talk a little bit about space travel now, since we're talking about it's a day trip to moon. You personally know Richard Branson, and you know how Virgin plans with not quite to the moon, but to the outer space travel. Do you think in the near future we may see a space travel to the moon?
Well, I think actually in the very near future, we will see what you might consider space tourism to the moon. There have been a number of space tourists thus far. Certainly Richard Branson and others are thinking of providing space tourism on a more regular basis. The first ones, I'm sure, are going to be suborbital flights. Later on, there's talk on Jeff Bezos talking about space hotels in low Earth orbit. And indeed, I believe that we might well see, even within the year, the first lunar space tourist. But this won't be going to the surface. This will just be doing rather like Apollo 8 did, a loop around the moon and then back. So there's a fairly safe orbit trajectory that if you go along that trajectory, you're guaranteed to come back. And that's probably quite an important thing for space tourism. So I think we may well see that within the next 12 to 18 months. And that will be the first time that we've had lunar tourism. Of course, tourism to go onto the surface is going to be a big step further, a lot more expensive, and that's going to be a little way off.
So we are here to remember the 50th anniversary. What do you think is the biggest legacy of Apollo mission to human being 50 years on?
Well, of course, there was a tremendous stimulation of technology. And when we think now, the brave men that landed on the moon and fortunately all got back safely were using less computing power at their fingertips than we have in our current smartphones. And it's quite terrifying to think how they managed to do that. Yep. So, obviously the technology was an enormous legacy. It stimulated a whole range of technical advances. But perhaps the one that's been the most lasting and perhaps the most profound is the impact it had on our psychology, on our thinking. We're no longer just earthbound. We have been to the moon. Okay, it's about time we went back, but we have been there. We stood on the moon and looked back at the Earth and saw how fragile the Earth is and how small it is and how it's just sitting in space. And I think these images and the images of men on the moon had a very deep impact on our psyche as a race. Now, I don't think we've made the most of it since then. We're still squabbling between nations and we have all manner of problems. We're not looking after our environment as well as we should do. But nevertheless, I think looking at the Earth from the moon and all the challenges to get there was something amazing. And of course, the thing was very different. There were a lot of novels written about going to the moon back in the 19th century. H.G. Wells and so forth wrote these. And a lot of what they said was actually carried out a little bit on the Apollo missions. But the one thing that they never imagined is that almost everybody in the world could watch while it happened. And so the fact that the vast majority, or a good majority of the population, was able to watch in real time as men landed and walked on the moon, I think had a tremendous impact.
And I guess it also inspired a whole generation of engineers and scientists after watching that the life of landing to go to the space industry doing research. In fact, recently people we're talking about. That generation is retiring, and we need a new generation coming to carry the flag, to do the space exploration, and perhaps a renewed interest of going to the moon or the Mars may inspire another generation in terms of really ignite people's imagination.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. As I said, you know, my interest in space and in all the aspects of that were stimulated by the moon landings. There's absolutely no doubt. And that lasted, I think, for my generation. Of course, they are now approaching retirement. And so the new generation, which hasn't experienced that novelty firsthand, now I think is facing a different novelty, and that is to see different stage of the human exploration of Mars. I mean, I think if you go back to the 1960s and 70s, it wasn't just the human lunar landings, but also the first images back from the Voyager missions of Jupiter and Saturn, which are continuing, you know, initially, then after that, followed by Hubble. A lot of these had a deep impact on the way we think and stimulated generations of people, young people, to get into science and technology. Now I think we're seeing the almost the commercialization of space, what is sometimes called new space. So the more commercial aspects of space, the more private sector involvement is now opening up different opportunities in space, and that's increasing the number of opportunities for young people to participate in it firsthand. And hopefully that will excite the next generation.
Because of the 50 years anniversary, I watched and listened to quite a lot of programs for revisit the Apollo mission. One thing I got the biggest impression was how young those people were. The mission control people were in their 20s, and you think back, they're really youth, and yet the whole nation put trust in a very young generation to make the miracle happen. So in that sense, I sometimes look at the Chinese mission control room and look at the young face. I said, wow, there are some similarity between the generation of Chinese, this generation, compared with the 50 years ago, the American generation. Do you think that in the Western world, we somehow have problem to inspire the younger generation coming to the space? Why these days somehow it's a bit slower compared with Chinese development?
Well, I think there's two things. The Apollo missions were driven by a overwhelming political agenda. The Americans had been caught unawares by the launch of Sputnik from Russia, and then the rapid development of the Russian space capability, and therefore Kennedy set this as a goal. And of course, there wasn't anybody there. I mean, there'd been clearly a long legacy in the Air Force, the US Air Force, of working on similar types of projects. But otherwise, this was a new venture. And so when they looked around for the people, and it was a colossal number of people that had to be involved, that's when they found a lot of the what now looked like a very young generation. And what's really interesting to note is that, and I forget when it was, but it may have been about 10 years ago now, or maybe a bit less, China also, I don't know whether they consciously examined this and took a decision, but I recall that everybody, all the engineers and professionals over the age of 50 or 55 or something, were asked to step back and hand over to the younger generation, who could perhaps move a little bit more agilely, had a fresher thinking and so forth. But very sensibly, the Chinese also said, well, we don't want you just to retire. We want you to sit back, sit in the seat behind. We'll relieve you of all the, you know, tedious managerial and administrative duties, but please contribute your experience to the younger generation, so that put them in charge of driving the car, but you sit in the back and just give them the odd bit of, you know, advice as to when not to crash the car. And I think this has been a very powerful ingredient in the development of the Chinese space capability. I think the way the systems is organized in China, it's easier to do that. In the West, it's very difficult to do that. It has to be done through different mechanisms. And I don't think we have quite the same political pressures that would encourage that to happen. However, who knows? Maybe now it will be the so-called new space generation, which are looking at smaller satellites using more commercial and IT type management techniques and so forth, who will stimulate a different way of thinking. And it won't be the same. It'll come up in a different package.
I guess the legacy of Apollo mission is wide, very wide range. I read an article from BBC, 10 legacy from the mission. One is microwave. Say the microwave was invented because the way they want to, how to heat things up and so on. I don't know how true it is. So as you said, probably there will have a lot of byproduct of the renewed interest of this new way of moon exploration. But if I ask you to predict, just now you said China may land first, but if I ask you to looking forward to predict who may land in the Mars first, what will you bet on?
Well, there's a couple of questions there. First of all, you know, the technology that was stimulated. I mean, there have been lots of examples quoted as to the technologies that have been used in the domestic field, which came out of the lunar and Apollo missions. And actually, a lot of them are apocryphal in that. And I think one of them is the non-stick frying pan, which, you know, I think is, you know, is debatable, to say the least. Of course, microwaves were around. They were invented during the Second World War, or not invented, but they were developed to an advanced state in the Second World War. And I'm not sure at what point somebody cooked something in front of their microwave antenna. But of course, it's quite possible that that was one of the stimuli of the space, the lunar missions that created the need for that. And of course, there were many others. I mean, in fact, it's very interesting to go back and you look at the communications quality of the video and the audio from Apollo 9, and then you look at the follow-on missions, and the video and the audio quality of the communications back from even the next mission was markedly different. And two missions on, there was no comparison. So it was driving development of techniques, you know, all the time. And that was one of those things. It's also interesting, I mean, one of the other apocryphal things was the development of the biro, because arguably NASA wanted to be able to write on a piece of paper, and so they spent an enormous amount of money to develop ink from a pen that wouldn't run out, and we ended up with the biro. Of course, the Russians had the same thing, and they did a lot cheaper by just using a pencil.
Yeah.
But most of these stories are apocryphal, but nevertheless, yeah, there was clearly a big advance. All right, and then, turning about who will go to Mars first, well, it's debatable, because, you know, the two private sector giants that are doing interplanetary travel really is SpaceX with Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, Blue Origin. And, you know, Elon has a vision, and he has always had it, and the whole reason for him doing what he's doing at the moment is to go to Mars. And, you know, he looks at it, this is an insurance policy for the human race, and insurance is generally a good thing to have, even if you never have to use it. So, you know, will he be first? It's a big challenge. On the other hand, the private sector can move much more quickly than the government sector, which has been talking about having Mars missions, which were planned in 2020. 15 years ago, and, you know, no nearer now. So, you know, I suspect that when you're looking at the big space agencies, it's going to be very difficult for them to do that. The costs are enormous, the risks are high, and I suspect it'll be the private sector. Now, will it be Blue Origin, or will it be SpaceX? Who knows? I think if I had to put my money, I'd put it on SpaceX first, but we'll see.
Thank you very much, Sir Martin, for sharing your thoughts on the moon mission 50 years on, what we should remember and what we will look forward. So I hope in my lifetime, I will be able to see human being, especially maybe Chinese, be able to land on the moon. That will be really fascinating. And for that, I will keep my fingers crossed and will live a long life.
And I hope we will see men and women on the moon. And hopefully also from different nations all working together, because it's a hard place to live.
Yes, indeed. It will be really nice if, as you said, built a moon village for peaceful use of the outer space. Thank you.
Thank you.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone. And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked.